One, two, three, gone. I pushed him out of me and nursed him and soothed him, and then one day he left here and didn't come back. Like he was nothing, and everything I felt for him was nothing, and all that time we felt it was good and strong and special, it was really no stronger than a strand of hair snipped in two. A few months after the accident, a man came with a document to sign, and that was it. Salvatore signed it and explained to me that there was nothing else they could do. They never found him in the river. He never washed up any place. Salvatore was as sad as I was, but it's different for men. He went to work and came home and seemed the same, but I knew better. We had three boys, and then we had two. A memory of Tobias Kirkenbauer ambled across Mary's mind. She saw herself tying him into his pram, pushing him down to the water with a picnic of bread and cheese. What did they say to each other? What was that funny way he said her name? She recalled the tiny hairs on the doctor's top lip when he warned her not to tell Mrs. Kirkenbauer that the boy was gone. If Mrs. Kirkenbauer had asked for him, Mary would have lied. And yet she died anyway. Though Mary had seen enough death to know what it looked like when it came, it was always a shock to see that whatever it is that animates a person can slip away so easily, like a drop of water slipped down a drain. Perhaps she found out, Mary considered. Perhaps a mother knows. I'm not telling you this for you to say sorry, Mary. Any decent person is sad to hear such a thing, so it's useless to say anything in response. I'm telling you this so you can see I know a little about men and about life. A woman who is married twice and has three children and gets herself to America with an infant alongside knows a little about the world and about men. You understand? You can imagine what it was like on that ship without a husband and with a boy to suckle. Mary waited for what she knew was coming. You should stay away from that Alfred. Mary felt the old defensiveness rise up, but swallowed it back down again. Well, anyway, he's married. Mila Borriello touched Mary's hand. How many hours was I with him since he found Mr. Driscoll and came up here to knock on my door? In all of those hours, not once does he mention his wife. The only woman he mentioned was you. Mary felt ashamed at the soaring she felt in her chest upon hearing this, at the familiar lightness in her bones that used to come over her when she'd hear his key in the door. Now that he'd seen her, he'd make excuses to come back, and she had to decide what she'd do when that happened. Liza Meany will never know him like I do, she thought. Then she remembered that Liza Meany had cured him, had convinced him to stick with a job, and, for Liza Meany, he'd proposed marriage, become a stepfather. She had a vision of herself on North Brother, looking across the water at Manhattan, thinking about what he could possibly be doing that would keep him from writing to her, from trying to see her. No, she decided. No. 18. On the night Driscoll was taken by ambulance, Alfred slept in the old man's rooms. He heeded Mary's advice and washed himself in the basin. Not wanting to sleep on the bed Driscoll had been coughing into, he found a spare blanket and made a bed on the kitchen floor. In the morning, he walked to the stable with his thoughts full of Mary and how he could put everything right again. As he cleaned the stalls and fed the horses, he decided he'd wait until after Samuel's exams to tell Liza what he now knew, that he could not be with her and certainly could not marry her. He'd wait until after Christmas, after the New Year. But when he got back to their rooms that afternoon and saw them there, mother at the sink and son at the table, and the way she warned him with a look to keep quiet, and winced when he took off his boots by the door and followed him around, touching everything he touched to straighten it, right it, clean it from whatever invisible grime he might have carried there on his fingertips, he knew he would not be able to stay there one day longer. He returned to his boots and went out the door before she could ask where he was going. Back on the sidewalk, he headed straight into the barrage of sound. Children shrieked, their mothers calling after them. The horses clopped, whinnying and snouting at anything that came near them. The carriages squeaked and rattled. The automobiles honked and sputtered as they tore down the streets, the passengers gripping the crossbars. Alfred sank into the bright busyness of the Lower East Side. He noticed, now, that many of the windows had Christmas candles waiting until nightfall to be lit, and remembered that Christmas was just 10 days away. The day was warm, more like October than December, and he walked in a westerly direction across Allen and Eldridge streets, through the blocks of All Italian, Mulberry, and Mott. He headed south along Lafayette and then west again until he came to the outdoor market on Chambers, where a 12-foot Yule tree was standing at the northwest corner, decorated with beads and tinsel. He bought a loaf of bread and a few slices of smoked trout wrapped in a newspaper. With the bread and fish tucked under his arm, he turned east again. After a few blocks, he stopped on a curb and ate his meal while a group of children kicked a ball around him. Licking his fingers, he continued toward the East River, passing the faces of 100 tenements standing shoulder to shoulder, like a row of tight-lipped and straight-backed soldiers. The zigzagging fire escapes, chipped and rusted, marred each facade, and Alfred knew without looking that the interior hallways were similarly spoiled, the plasters cracked and crumbling, the pastoral scenes painted over and over again until every color was a shade of gray. On one block alone, he passed a delicatessen, a butcher, a baker, a milliner, a tailor, and a factory that made women's shoes. He passed a police officer who was trying to coax a dog from the street, and another officer yelling up to a man who had thrown a pile of chicken bones from his fifth-floor window. The man shouted back to the officer in German and then pulled the curtain across. "Want me to tell you what he said?" Alfred asked the officer. "Don't bother," the officer replied and continued on. Alfred turned and turned and turned again until before him was the Brooklyn Bridge. That shining, massive jewel suspended over the water and held there, it seemed from Alfred's vantage, by magic, by a simple crosshatch of wire and string. He was a German, the man who thought how to do that. Alfred marveled as he stared at how the bridge seemed to take a flying leap across the tidal strait below. He recognized the Gothic towers of the Old World, except instead of appearing bulky and grim like they did in the Rhine country, here in America they held only promise, and the arched portals carved into them seemed to Alfred to welcome those who crossed like a collection of solemn ancestors, holding the new Americans in the palms of their hands. He walked across the bridge and then jumped the trolley on the Brooklyn side, held tight to the bar, and after a long time hopped off at Coney Island, where, passing the loop-the-loop and packs of young girls pressed into circles, talking behind their hands and laughing, he remembered bringing Mary there when Aunt Kate was still alive and watching her as she danced with other girls. Even then, it was a rare thing to see her so joyous, and even more rare as time went on, but it was worth the wait, and even severe Mary, even worried Mary, even Mary with a cook's slouch was worth 100 Liza Meanies. It was nearly midnight when Alfred got back to Liza's rooms, and after climbing the narrow stairs, he listened at the door for a minute to discover whether she was still awake, waiting for him, or if the boy was still studying at the table. He thought about what he'd say, whether he'd hold her or if that was wrong, whether he'd tell the boy himself or let her do it. He heard nothing, and there was no light under the door. It will come as a shock to her, Alfred knew. She might not be able to make ends meet without him. She mightn't be able to send the boy to school. But she'll take on another boarder. A woman would be better for her, and the neighbors would like it more. I'll send her a letter, he decided, as he turned and made his way back down to the street. It would be kinder to Liza to avoid the shame of having to watch him leave, or the temptation she might have to beg him to stay. It would be more honorable to allow her to face that on her own, and then she could tell Samuel whatever she liked. Alfred would simply never return to Orchard Street at all. As for the few articles he'd left behind in her place, she could do what she liked with them. Then he remembered he had $31 saved in a coffee can on the top shelf of the pantry, and that stopped him as he crossed the first floor landing. He looked up the dark stairwell and listened. After a few seconds, he shook his head and waved his hands in front of him as if he were scattering that paper money in the breeze. He stepped toward the heavy front door, believing he'd made his decision, but he thought of that money again as he placed his hand on the knob. He could see it as a stack turned on its side and curved against the can. It smelled of coffee. What would Liza do with it? Buy books for the boy? He climbed the stairs again. He placed the palm of his hand against the door and then turned the knob, slowly, slowly, so that the lock wouldn't pop like a gunshot and wake her up. He pushed it open, only far enough to slide his body inside, and in 3 steps he was standing at the pantry, peering toward the top shelf. Empty. He scanned the lower shelves, the counter, the curio in the corner. The floorboard creaked as his thumb grazed the miniature collectible bell she'd gotten from Philadelphia, years and years ago from her husband, the boy's father, dead at 27. Alfred was rooted in the still silence until he remembered the small hollow in the brick wall between the window and the curio, a little space gouged out long before his arrival and impossible to notice unless a person went looking for it. Liza had pointed it out to Samuel as a good place to keep his earnings, and Alfred went up on tiptoe now, reaching around the curio to find it in the moonlight. There was his coffee can, and next to it, a chipped sugar bowl full of the boy's earnings. Graceful as a ballerina, he leaned down, plucked up both, and barely felt the floor under him as he slipped out the door, back to the hall, down to the street. For the first time since taking the cure, he reached for the flask that held the medicine, and there on the dark sidewalk he tipped it into his mouth, pretended it was whiskey, and swallowed every drop. When he was finished, he waited to see if the medicine would do the trick, if it would take all that wanting away and turn it into satisfaction, into the calm easiness of sobriety as Dr. Oppenheimer had described it. The peace of needing nothing, a feeling sound in body and mind. Instead, he felt violence in his belly, and as quick as he could lean over, he vomited on himself and all over the step. He stumbled to the curb and vomited over the dog shit there. He dropped down to his hands and knees and vomited again. When he saw in the dim light of the gas lamp a policeman coming up the street with his hand on his club, he moved along as quickly as he could. He stuck close to the buildings and walked north until he came to a church with a small cemetery beyond its gates. He tried to vomit again, but nothing came because there was nothing left, so he retched dryly behind a headstone, wrapped his coat more tightly around his body, stumbled over to a bench, and slept. In the morning, cold to the bone and with an aching neck, he made his way to Washington Square Park. The Borriello boy had said the laundry Mary worked at was almost on the park, but he hadn't had a chance to tell him which side. How close almost was. Buttoned into the inside pocket of his coat was his $31 plus Samuel's $11. $11 was nothing compared to the dinners he'd put on their table, compared to all the pencils and books and scratch pads he'd purchased, the groceries, the new kitchen curtains, all acquired with money he'd given her. She'd made out well, he told himself, the thick stack of money a lump on the left side of his coat. He began searching at the park's south end, but found no laundry. There was a laundry a block from the park's west side, but when he went in to inquire about Mary, they didn't know who he was talking about. It was the same at the 2 laundries he found within a few blocks north of the park. Then, on the park's east side, he spotted a sign and knew it must be the place. He watched a Chinese move around the front of the store and then had a glimpse of her, passing through a back room, carrying a stack of folded clothes. Though the vomit had dried on his pants and shoes, the stench seemed as strong as it had been when fresh, and when he touched his hand to his face, he knew that he needed a wash and a shave. He was hungry. He wanted to rinse his teeth. The Chinese came to the door, noticed him, and turned his back. He needed to make himself presentable. He needed to consider what he'd say. Instead of speaking to her right then, as he'd planned, he walked to the old building and got himself into Driscoll's rooms by the key Driscoll left over the frame of the door. He stripped in Driscoll's kitchen and then went into the old man's closet to find a shirt, pants, fresh socks, hurrying out of the contaminated room as quickly as he could. He found Driscoll's blade and cream. When he was finished and standing in the kitchen with Driscoll's bedroom door shut tight, he made a mug of strong black coffee and sipped it beside the stove. He felt jumpy, as if being chased, as if those pursuing him were crouched outside in the street, spying on him from the upper floors of the buildings lining the avenue. He placed Driscoll's key on the table and locked the door behind him. He walked directly over to the laundry. It was near quitting time, but she would not see him. A Chinese looked him up and down with those inscrutable eyes and told him that she could not be disturbed. He told the man he would wait as long as he had to. He raised his voice and sent it toward the back of the shop, where the sounds of cranks and pulleys and the sudden hiss of steam went on as if he weren't there at all. The smell of damp clothing and hot irons filled the small space, and he wondered if she smelled like that now. Where before she'd smelled of fruit and fresh bread, now she might smell of starch and laundry powder. She'd heard him. He could feel it. She was listening. He told the Chinaman to call the police if he wanted to. He didn't care. And then, not 15 minutes later, he was back on the street again, walking into the wind that pricked his face like 100,000 needles, turning his shoulder to slice through the throngs hustling about with their packages tied up with string. He circled around the neighborhood for a while and then went back to the laundry and stood outside the door. "Mary," he said, when she finally came out, as he knew she would, eventually. Two other women had already left, and the sign on the door said closed. "I need to talk to you." She stayed several feet away from him on the sidewalk and wrapped her scarf around her head. "No, Alfred, I don't think so. I think the time for talking is past. I didn't marry her, you know." Mary leveled a look at him. "And? What am I supposed to do? Thank you?" "No, I only..." "Go away, Alfred. Please, leave me alone." He watched her walk away, and he waited for her to stop, look over her shoulder, think of something more to say to him. But she turned onto Green Street and disappeared. He needed to change his tack. He needed to find a way to explain himself. In the short term, he realized he shouldn't have locked himself out of Driscoll's flat. He had a stack of money, but he didn't want to waste it, so he walked over to 8th Street, to a delicatessen where an old friend from his coal-hauling days worked slicing meat, and asked to sleep in the pallet in their supply room. In the morning, he waited outside 302 East 33rd, but he must have arrived too late and missed her. He passed by the laundry a few times to kill the hours until they closed, but didn't catch any glimpses of her. Christmas was now only 8 days away. Pale children begged from morning until night, and there was a Santa on every other block. The markets smelled of clove and cinnamon, and the men hawking evergreens were asking astonishing prices for trees that, by New Year's, would be brown and brittle and back on the curb. What he needed was courage. What he needed was to figure out exactly the right thing to say. He shoved his fists deep into his coat pockets because when he set them free, his arms felt out of rhythm with his body. He put up his collar. He walked faster. His flask was empty now, and he kept reminding himself to go to Oppenheimer's office for more of the medicine, but it was like the old prayers of his childhood. His mind said the words, but the words were meaningless, and he barely heard them. The thought of filling it with something better came to him innocently the first time, as he passed a pub he used to like. But as soon as the thought entered his mind, it gained traction and wouldn't be pushed away. He tried to think instead of how he and Mary would talk, finally, and how life would go on, but every time he let his guard down, there it was, an itch in his chest demanding to be scratched. He walked and walked and bought a comb for his hair and better socks for his feet, but there it was, squatting in the corner of his mind and smirking at him. "If I limit myself to a dram," he considered. His groin tingled. He felt his pulse in the soles of his feet and his fingertips. "If I tell the barman it's only the one, and to not, under any circumstances, sell me another. If I drink it up quickly and then go on my way. If I never do it again after this." He walked back to the pub he'd passed that morning. Quickly, he caught the barman's eye and held up his first finger. The barman found a bottle, and Alfred nodded. The barman found a glass, set it on the bar, poured from one vessel into the other, all of which Alfred watched closely, as if trying to spot the sleight of hand in a card trick. The barman restored the bottle to the shelf and placed the glass in front of Alfred. Alfred removed his hat, swallowed it down, and returned the empty glass to the bar. "Geez, brother," the man said, eyeing him. "We don't run tabs here." "I have money." The second time, Alfred looked at the amber liquid for a moment before swallowing it in two long gulps. The polished wood of the bar stretched out to his right and curved into the shadows at the back of the room. The glasses, lined up in neat rows behind the barman, caught the faint sun coming through the windows. He felt nervous out there in the city, the tendons and sinews of his body mimicking the hectic pace all around him, leaving him exhausted, leaving him unable to relax, his ears always cocked like a hare waiting for the sound of approaching hounds. Here, Alfred noticed, the encroaching city stopped its march at the door, and at the center of his body the heat from those two small drams worked better than any overcoat, worked better than the warmest feather bed. The others, seated at the bar, were silent, except for a pair of gentlemen toward the back discussing something in a whisper. There was no music playing, and the barman had not even bothered to put out the token plate of cheese. Alfred felt a familiar calm traveling outward from his belly. He had lost his mother as a boy, but he knew that feeling was what a boy feels when he steps into his mother's arms, that tenderness, that fierce compassion. He shifted in his stool to find the familiar position. He rested his chin to his fist. He counted the days since he'd shown up for work at the stable and wondered if he still had a job. If they fired him, maybe it would be for the better. That way, when he got his fresh start with Mary, he'd find something else. He ordered a beer with his whiskey. He could move furniture, maybe. He could go out and harvest ice instead of waiting in the stables for it. When the quitting hour rolled around, he didn't bother going over to the laundry, deciding instead that he'd have better luck catching her outside their old building. He didn't bother with dinner or supper. The other men left, and a new group took their places. His stack of cash was getting lighter, and sometime after supper, after the barman had cleaned the glasses and wiped down the top of the bar, he asked Alfred if he had somewhere to go. Alfred straightened up, leapt from the stool, hurried out to the street. The laundry had been closed for several hours, so Alfred sat inside the vestibule of 302 East 33rd Street for 6 hours before she appeared. He was leaning with his back against the wall, his legs stretched out in front of him, when he opened his eyes to find her looking down on him with a newspaper under her arm and an umbrella in her hand. "What are you doing?" she said. "Waiting for you." She leaned over to sniff the air, and then, like she'd been scalded, she jumped, pulled her long skirt to the side, and tried to step past him to the front door. "Wait," he said. And quick as he could be, he reached for her ankle. He felt that delicate knob of bone move under his thumb as she tried to wiggle free. "Let me go," she said with that fierce look she got whenever she was angry. He let go. "What do you want? Why are you here? I wish you'd keep away from me." "Didn't you hear me say I'm not married? I didn't marry her." Mary gave one of those quick, breathy laughs he knew marked the point when she was about to lose her temper completely. He stood and stepped back until he was against the wall. He'd forgotten what she could be like. He'd forgotten everything. She held her pointing finger 1 inch from his nose. "You stay away from me. Do you understand? Don't come to the laundry. Don't come to this building. Don't look for me on the street." "You don't mean it. I know you don't mean it." He thought of her stooping over him in the early mornings. He thought of her pushing his clothes into the tub and wringing them and shaking them out in 2 deft snaps before hanging them by the stove. He thought of the soft swing of her breasts while she worked and the swell of her bare white hip in the morning and the way she was careful about her hands, always rubbing the fingertips in lemon to take away the odor, and how he wanted to kiss those hands now and tell her that she could not send him away. Sometimes, not often, but sometimes, she would listen to a story he told her about the bar, about some person he'd met there, and if the story was funny, she'd laugh. She'd drop what she was doing, sink into her side of the bed, and laugh. Sometimes, not often, she would ignore the dawn light that insisted it was time to wake up, and instead she'd roll over toward him, throw her arm over his chest, make a nest in the crook of his arm. Even when she was upstate, or in New Jersey, or across town at a situation that didn't permit journeys home, he never felt alone, knowing she would be coming back to him. She made a small, choked sound now, a sound he'd heard out of her only once or twice since she was 17. She drew a deep breath, and when she looked at him again, she had composed herself. "Please," she said, and he felt sobered. "But, Mary, I know it would be different now. I haven't..." Mary moved forward quickly, as if she was going to hit him, all that rage simmering just below the features of her face, leaving a model of her cheeks. A man's rage, as they'd noted in the newspapers. An animal's rage. An immigrant's rage. Something that required 4, 5, 6 generations to be properly bred out. But it was only a flicker, and when he blinked, she had already drawn herself back, closed her eyes, and then, after a beat, descended the front steps to the sidewalk. "I mean it, Alfred," she said, and next thing, she was gone. He roamed the city to clear his head, pausing only on park benches and bar stools. He spent that night stretched on the long seat of a Model T parked under a tree on 57th Street, the owner's blanket pulled up to his chin, and then spent the next day at Nation's Pub. When the car was gone the next evening, he found another. He went on this way for a few days, until he remembered the ice company's stable, and how warm it would be there with all the animals lined up in their rows, the doors and windows shut tight. Since it was now just a few days until Christmas, there would be no one there except the poor soul who got elected to come by to feed the animals, shake out fresh straw. The stable was empty. Alfred scrambled through a window that stayed closed all winter but was never locked. Inside, staggering now with exhaustion, he pushed bunches of hay together on the dirt floor, found a spare horse blanket. He'd tell whoever came that he was back on a shift, that he was meant to be there. They would believe him. He slept for hours, and when he woke, it was deep darkness, the horses breathing gently, the one closest to him snorting, as if asking Alfred if he'd woken, if he was all right now. He sat, pulled his stiff knees into his chest. Mary would come around. She had to. If she didn't, Alfred considered, then there was not a single person in New York City, not a single person in the world who cared what happened to him. Alfred stretched, went into the back room in search of food, and instead found half a bottle of John Powers. Solemn in the face of such good luck, he picked it up as carefully as he might a baby, and brought it tenderly back to the spot where he'd slept. He slid to the ground. He pulled a blanket across his knees. Closing his eyes, he uncorked the bottle and drew a long, ravenous mouthful. Sometime later, he wasn't sure how long, he noticed the sky outside was gray, and he couldn't decide if that meant day was turning into evening or night into morning. He placed the empty bottle on the windowsill. He made his way to the back room again, where a simple, straight-back chair loomed before him, and behind, the horses made threatening noises with their throats and stamped their feet. It was darker now, and he found a lamp, found a bottle of oil, found a match. Had Christmas come yet? Was it now? He removed the glass and the wick holder and poured in the oil from the plain, unmarked canister in the corner of the room, cursing as some dripped onto the seat of the chair. He twisted off the blackened top of the wick with his fingertips. He shook out a wooden match and struck once, twice. The match broke. He dropped it on the ground, kicked it, shook out another. This time, he heard that small suck of surrounding air, and when the light was born, Alfred held it for a moment before touching it to the tip of the wick. Later, looking back at the moment when the flame met the cloth of the wick, he would see it so clearly that he would remember if he'd been more sober than he realized. He couldn't recall the weather outside or the state of his clothing, or the color of that horse blanket, or the last meal he had put in his belly, but he could remember that flame and the white of that wick. It was as if his mind had taken a photograph that he was able to study only later, the position of the can, the direction of the spout, the odor of the oil. He touched the flame to the wick and swore later that he knew, just before it happened, an instant before, a heartbeat before, a space of time so small it would have been impossible to measure. He knew as he was doing it, as he watched the orange meet the white, and one hair to the other side, and he would have known before. He would have stopped. He touched the flame to the wick, and the room exploded. 19. And just like that, he was gone. I wanted him to leave, Mary reminded herself. I asked him to. All he did was listen. Christmas came, and she gave the Borriello boys a set of checkers to share. They had bought her pins for her hair, and as they talked and ate and admired the Christmas tree they'd decorated with strings of popcorn, Mary expected him to knock on the door, beg to see her. Why hadn't he married Liza? Did she kick him out when he came home stewed, or did he need a drink only when he saw Mary? At the laundry, the Lithuanians gasped when she told Lee to tell Chu that she wouldn't be Wranglewoman anymore. She'd had enough. She would wash. She would do her turns at the front of the store, but no more ironing on a Sunday half-day either. And on top of that, she wanted a raise. He won't do it, Lee warned. Irina and Rasa have been here 5 years. No increase. Not for you either. Well then, Irina and Rasa deserve a raise too, she said. What would you do if all of us left you at once? How much business would he lose training three at the same time? More than three, since together we do the work of five. There's striking and organizing going on all over the city. Why not us? Even outside of the laundry, she felt the world back away from her lately, grant her passage in a way it didn't do for others. When she walked into shops and pushed her goods across the counter, people shrank further within their overcoats. She argued prices to the penny. She inspected packages for dents, fruit for bruises, meat for dark spots, clothing for loose threads, and brought everything to the attention of the grocer or the butcher or the shop assistant. She bought a pair of shoes and brought them back 2 days later to say there was a wobble in the left heel. "There's no wobble," the man said without touching the shoe, without even putting down the polish rag he was holding. Looking at the haughty expression on his face, he a cobbler with black fingertips, his vest hanging open and missing a button, Mary felt as if time slowed down. She took the shoe out of her bag and dropped it onto the counter with a clatter. She felt the eyes of every other person in the shop. "There is a wobble. I want my money back." "Did you wear them?" the man asked as he inspected the sole, and she said of course she wore them. How in the world would she know about the wobble if she hadn't worn them? The clock ticked. She could hear the soft grunts of a second man stretching the leather in the back room, the rhythmic punch of the sewing machine. The man at the counter pointed to a sign, "No returns on worn shoes." She nodded at him and then, raising her voice, announced, "This place sells broken shoes and refuses refunds." She went to the shop door, pushed it open, and repeated it to a group of women passing by. A man browsing the selection inside the door slipped by her and hurried down the street. She picked up the sign on the women's side of the display window. "This says comfort shoes. Is that meant to be a joke?" "What's your story, lady?" the man asked, his hands on his hips. "I spent my money here thinking I'd gotten something for it. I'll stand here for a month if I have to, telling people about this place and about the crookery that goes on here." She crossed her arms and looked at the man until finally, releasing a single loud sigh, he opened the cash drawer and returned her money. One day in January, she saw a cook she recognized leaving from the side door of a restaurant, and the thought of that woman basting and chopping and sautéing in there felt to Mary like a hand closed over her throat. For the first time in all those months of her new life, she didn't return to the laundry after her lunch break. Only at home, at Mila Borriello's table, did she feel some peace. She watched the boys do their figures. She took the scrub brush from her friend and helped her wash the floor. Jimmy Tiernan came upstairs and knocked one evening when his Patricia was out. Mila and the boys were also out. "Come in," Mary said, pointing at the empty chair. "Nah," Jimmy said, and leaned against the jamb of the door. "I was just wondering if you've seen Alfred." Mary turned to the counter and made herself busy with the coffee pot, measuring out spoonfuls and cups of water. "No, why?" "Well, a little while back I told him about a job starting up, you know, the new skyscraper being built down across from City Hall. He seemed interested, said he was getting bored at the stable, and told me to get him on. Then I don't hear nothing from him, not a peep. I told the boss I had a guy I wanted to get on, but he can't hold it much longer." Mary turned and leaned against the counter. "I haven't seen him, Jimmy. I don't know." "Well, where is he?" "I said I don't know." "Okay, okay." Jimmy held up his hands. "I just wondered because I tried that address down on Orchard, and the lady acted like she didn't know who I was talking about. He hasn't been around there either." Mary brought her fingertips to her temples and rubbed. "You know how he is. You tried at Nations?" "Yeah, I tried Nations. They haven't seen him neither. Tommy says he came in like a king a little before Christmas, but they haven't seen him since." Mary put her hand on the door. Inch by inch she moved it, and inch by inch Jimmy Tiernan retreated back into the hall. "Well, if you see him, Mary, tell him thanks for nothing, 'cause I went out on a limb here, you know?" Mary shut the door, and Jimmy shouted from the other side, "But tell him check in with me anyway, will you, Mary, when you see him? Tell him I'm not mad, just wondering is all." Mary curled up on her cot and closed her eyes. One Sunday in February 1911, an Irish woman named Mrs. O'Malley, whom Mary knew a little and who lived in the building across the street, came looking for her to help with a hog her husband had won in a round of cards up on 102nd Street. Drunk and cocky, the husband had shown up at home with the 200-pound beast on a tether and could not explain to his wife's satisfaction how he'd gotten the animal so far downtown. She told Mary that he presented the hog to her like he was giving her a basket full of money or a room full of red roses, something beautiful or practical that she should appreciate. But instead, it had been up to her to guard the animal where it now lived in the alley behind their tenement, tied to a piece of fence beside the common privy. He'd been there almost a week. "And now I guess it's time to do something with him," Mary said. "It is," Mrs. O'Malley said. "And I'm useless." There was no sense asking if she'd consulted with a butcher, because Mary knew, if the tables were turned, she wouldn't have sought out a butcher either. He would charge more than the pig was worth and keep the best parts for himself. "I've a good mind to turn him out and pretend it never happened, because where in God's name will I store the meat? But every time I go to do it, it nags me that someone else will get him. I'd rather keep some of the meat and give the rest away. My neighbors will pay me something for it." The woman clasped her hands together. "I'd be very grateful to you." It was not cooking. It was butchering. All the cooking would be done by those lucky ones who got a part. Still, Mary hesitated. She rubbed her eyes. She tried to think about it clearly, while also wondering if she was still strong enough to butcher a full-grown hog. "Show him to me," she said, finally, and Mrs. O'Malley clapped once before grabbing Mary's hand and thanking her. Full of purpose now, Mrs. O'Malley led Mary down the stairs, across the avenue, in through her building's front door, out through the back door, and down four rickety wooden steps. There, in the frost-bitten and muddy yard, was the hog, rooting at the base of the fence. Mary crouched beside him, put her hand on his back. At least it's winter, she thought. They wouldn't have to worry about flies. She took off a glove and tested the dexterity of her fingers in the cold. The animal grunted and stamped. The fog of his breath rose up to meet Mary's throat, and she felt the same suspicion she always did when she was around animals, that they knew their fate, that they were born knowing it, that they were wiser than any human gave them credit for. She felt tenderness for him. "What floor are you on?" "Fifth." Mrs. O'Malley turned and pointed up to a distant window. "We'll do it here," Mary said, without taking her eyes from the hog. "I have good knives at my place, but you can find me a long, thin one for sticking him. Get me a saw if you can find one, a hammer, as many clean buckets as you can manage, twine. I'm going to search out a few bits of wood to raise him up. When we have everything, I'll need boiling water, a lot of it, and quickly. When you've gathered everything and put on the water, go around and ask the neighbors who want some of the meat. Tell a few of them to come down to help us turn him, then come straight back to me." By the time Mrs. O'Malley returned, Mary had led the hog to a shaded patch of clean-looking grass in the farthest corner of the yard. Mrs. O'Malley handed over the hammer and the knives Mary had instructed her to bring, and the four buckets she'd scrubbed, three borrowed, one her own. And when she was ready, when both women had removed their coats and gloves and hung them carefully on the fence, Mary told Mrs. O'Malley to get up on the pig's back and brace him for the blow. It had been 8 or 10 years at least, but her aim was still perfect, and the animal fell heavily. "Now," Mary said, grabbing him by his massive head and using every drop of strength in her body to stick him. As she pressed the knife deeper, Mrs. O'Malley held the first bucket against him to catch what she could. Mary's heart pounded, and she felt the heat from her body form a barrier against the cold of the day. Both women looked troubled as they watched so much of the sweet blood run into the grass under the fence, down the gentle dirt slope toward the privy. "Did you put on water?" Mary asked, and Mrs. O'Malley jumped up, ran into the building, and up five flights of stairs. When she came back a few minutes later, she was holding a pot full of boiling water and poured it over the animal from head to hoof. "Have another," she said, breathless, when the pot was empty, and came down a moment later with a second pot. Mary went to work with the blade of her knife, removing the hair. An hour later, Mary ran her hand gently over the pink skin to feel for an errant hair, and felt something move inside her as she looked at the animal, its blank eyes staring at an old metal bucket. He was a pathetic creature, had probably had a miserable life, and here he was. Mary pushed the knife into the pig's belly, feeling with her fingers that the intestines were still intact. She pulled out the guts and tossed them toward the second bucket. Moving back up toward the head, she felt the hem of her skirt heavy with blood. She twisted and pulled the hog's head free and dropped it in the third bucket. "I'll take that for my trouble," Mary said. Smelling the inside of that body was like smelling Ireland again. And she remembered being a girl, bringing the cow's stomach and intestines to the river, and the chill that ran through her to see the eels shoot out from under rocks the very same instant, it seemed, as the first drop of filth hit the water. By the time Mary arrived at the heart, the neighbors had begun to line up with their pots and bowls. Mila was there, and both boys, each with a vessel to carry a part home. Late that night, much later than her usual bedtime hour, after deciding that her clothes could not be saved, she scrubbed her body in the tub, pressed her knuckles into her aching arms, cleaned underneath her fingernails, and noted that she felt wide awake. Mrs. O'Malley had pressed money into her hand, and Mary had taken it. But it wouldn't have mattered to her if she'd gotten nothing. All day long, and even now, so many hours after helping Mrs. O'Malley wrap up those bits and pieces she wanted to keep for herself, Mary felt like someone had finally turned on a proper light after living for so long in a dim room. She smiled at the snout peeking up over the rim of Mila's largest pot.
"You haven't seen him yet?"
Jimmy Tiernan called from across the street one early morning in March. Mary pretended she didn't hear. He caught her again coming into the building a few days later. "I think it's the strangest thing," he commented, as if he and Mary were a pair of abandoned children together in their hurt. She tried to let it in one ear and out the other, but once again she began looking for Alfred when she stepped out of the building in the mornings. Michael Driscoll had not survived, and several of them from the building had gone to the funeral mass, but Alfred did not show. The first anniversary of her release from North Brother came and went without anyone noticing, and by herself she took the IRT uptown, walked over to the river, and stared across. She had never looked up John Kane. They'd never taken their walk together in Central Park. She'd felt less patience at the laundry ever since butchering the pig. What she'd told herself to accept, what she'd tried to face as permanent, could not continue. She was not a laundress, and she never would be. It was no different from being on North Brother, looking out over the churning water at the life she was missing on the other shore. And then, one warm Saturday afternoon in late March, when she was working the cash register and insisting to a gentleman that they'd done their absolute best with the ink stain on his shirt pocket, but that it simply could not be removed, she stopped to sniff the air. The gentleman also sniffed and followed his nose to the door. For the first time in more than a year, the Lithuanians put down their garments, dried their hands, and came to the front of the store. Everyone heard the alarm bell sound next door. "What is it?" Mary asked. From somewhere over their heads came a sound like thunder that grew louder and louder every second until one of the street doors of the Ash Building swung open and people, mostly young women, began to run out to the street. Leaving the gentleman's shirt on the counter and clutching the key to the register in her fist, Mary left her post, walked out to Washington Place, around the corner to Green Street, and when she saw the crowds looking up, she also looked up and saw what appeared to be a heap of clothes falling from an upper-floor window. Saving their materials, Mary thought. But she wondered at the moaning from the crowd as another bundle was sent down. A man fainted and the people beside him barely noticed. Mary moved closer to the outer fringe of the crowd. The fire truck's siren could be heard in the distance, moving closer. Coins rained from above along with the bundles of clothing, and Mary wondered that no one was reaching for them. No one was moving except for one woman who was wailing and thrashing and calling out for God, and Mary worked her way closer, excusing herself and pushing forward through the police officers who did nothing, the gentlemen and ladies, the bakers from across the street, the passers-by, a pair of children who were looking up with open mouths. Finally, when Mary got through the crowd, she saw that the bundles had legs and arms and faces, many of which had been singed black. She looked up and saw framed in a ninth-floor window a trio of girls holding hands. The girl on the left was swatting her hair, which had caught fire, and all three were shouting something that no one on the sidewalk could understand. They jumped at the same time, and two of the three held hands until they hit the sidewalk. The third, the one with the burning hair, covered her face with her hands, and as she fell, her body became piked, her head almost touching her knees, like children do sometimes when they are jumping off rocks into water and want to impress one another. It took Mary a second to understand that there was no water. This was no game. These girls were jumping to their deaths, and, far above their heads, the crowd could glimpse a man's arms as he helped them to the ledge as easily as he might have assisted them up the boarding step of the trolley. Two more followed, then two more. They jumped from other windows as well, in singles and pairs and groups of three. The man who had come into the laundry with the ink-stained shirt shouted at them to wait. "Please wait. The fire trucks were coming, and they would be saved. Wait," he commanded, even after they were already falling. Finally, a fire truck arrived, and then another. The crowd made way for them. The trucks pulled up close to the building. The firemen unwound their hoses, stretched their ladders up, up, up as high as they would go, and after looking hard at those folded-up ladders and looking again at the distance to the 8th, 9th, 10th floors, Mary dropped to a crouch and prayed. "They're not going to reach," a nearby man's voice said. "By God, they're too short by 3 stories." The collective moan grew louder and louder and swallowed everything. 2 more jumped, then another, another. When they hit the ground, it was as loud as an automobile crashing into a wall. Through the forest of legs at the base of the ash building, Mary could make out the back of a woman's head on the sidewalk, a careful braid threaded through her curls. The laundry was closed for a week as the bodies were lined up in makeshift coffins on the sidewalk, and families tried to identify their loved ones by a watch or locket, by a pattern of stitches on a stocking, a particular ribbon in the hair. The line went on and on, hundreds of bewildered people in their mourning clothes, while the charred and broken bodies waited to be claimed in the crisp, late March sun. In the days after the fire, it seemed to Mary that everyone in the city, from the Upper West Side to the quays of Lower Manhattan, moved about in grief. Papers were sold, cafes were open, but the world went silent. In another week or so, the accusations would begin. Why was the exit door locked? Why hadn't the alarm sounded on the upper floors? But in those first few days, when people spoke, it was of one subject only. All those girls. All those beautiful girls. 20.
"How could I go back?"
Mary asked her caseworker at the Department of Health. It was a busy place, and among the clicking of heels on the polished wood floor, the scrape of chairs, the racket of a ringing telephone, and the blusterous argument spilling out from behind half-open office doors, Mary had to raise her voice to be heard. It was the end of May, 1911, and Mary had been checking in with them every 3 months, as required. The first time she'd checked in, the whole office seemed to halt when she announced her name. Every man or woman behind a desk paused to watch her approach. They'd glanced at one another as she took a seat in the waiting area, and when her name was called, their eyes followed her across the room. Now, at her 4th visit, a different caseworker each time, they barely noticed her, and most didn't look up from the stacks of paperwork on their desk. The staccato music of struck typewriter keys, the zip and ding of carriages returned, never ceased. The office was sinking under all the paperwork. File drawers left open, envelopes, writing pads, stationery, ribbons of ink loosened from spools and piled on chairs, on windowsills, heaped in corners. She wondered if she could talk them into letting her check in every 6 months instead of every 3. She debated telling them about quitting the laundry, but there was nothing to feel guilty about. And if she was as free as they claimed she was, then there was nothing they could do to her for it.
"I couldn't possibly go back. You don't know what it was like that day."
"Ah," the man said, looking at the address. "I see." Everyone had an opinion about the Triangle Waste Company tragedy, but relatively few, considering the size of the city, had been there to witness it.
"Go home now,"
Mary had said to a pair of boys who had stopped to watch. They reminded her of the Borriello boys. But they didn't move, only stared up at the burning ash building like everyone else, until Mary took the smaller one by the shoulders, turned him around, put her forehead against his and shouted, "Go home! Do you hear me? Go home!" He blinked at her, and then, taking the older boy's hand, they ran away together. The man rifled through some papers. "How have you been making ends meet since leaving the laundry?" "None of your business," Mary wanted to shout, but instead she counted to 10. "The woman I board with takes in lacework for a milliner. She's been showing me how."
"But no cooking, correct? I see here that that is the agreement you came to when you left custody. You understand that?"
Mary could tell by the change in his face, the sudden light, that he had not realized until that moment who she was. Her file said Mary Mallon, but she could guess what he was thinking. Typhoid Mary.
"It says here that you risk infecting others if you cook for them."
"I know what it says." He closed the file, pushed back from his desk.
"It will take a while to get you a position at another laundry," the man said. He brought his hands together and regarded her for a moment. Have you considered factory work?
Factory work?
Mary blinked, thought of herself among the throngs of women who waited outside the glassworks or the clocks manufacturer for the starting bell. They had to ask permission to use the lav. They had to punch in and out with time cards. At night, when they left, they had to be patted down in case they'd pocketed the small parts, just like the girls in the Triangle Fire had been checked for scraps of silk and velvet.
Do you realize I've cooked for the Blackhouses? For the Gillespies? I've cooked for Henry and Adelaide Frick and several of their friends.
She crossed her arms.
I won't be working in any factory.
You're not in a position to be haughty, Miss Mallon. We're not an employment agency, so we have to assign someone the job of getting new work for you.
I just don't have the time.
Truthfully, you might have better luck going through an agency. They might know of vacancies at private homes. Mary wondered how old he was, if he still went home to his mama for supper. I've been finding work since I was born.
Put that in your file. I don't need any help from you, and I certainly don't need to be helped into another situation as wrangler.
The man sighed. Fine. Whenever you get something, make sure to stop again and let us know the details.
I look forward to it.
She slammed his office door on her way out. For the first time since leaving North Brother more than a year earlier, Mary felt unobserved as she made her way down the avenue. The man had forgotten to send her for a sample, and she smiled, quickening her step in case he might remember and run after her. Why had she never considered quitting before, finding something with better terms? She stopped in on the fishmonger on First Avenue and bought a pound of mussels. She stopped again for white wine, parsley, butter, a pair of shallots, a loaf of bread. It would be a treat for Mila. Supper ready when she came home. And lately, she'd been doing more and more of the cooking, and Mila had agreed that she could take the price of the groceries out of her board. No one had ever said anything about cooking for herself or cooking for friends without being paid for it. But still, before she cooked for them the first time, she reminded Mila of what Dr. Soper had said about her, why she'd spent almost 3 years on North Brother. She loved cooking and would like to help, but if Mila didn't want her boys to eat what she made, she would understand.
"Did you have the fever?"
Mila asked.
"No,"
Mary said.
"The truth.
More truth.
They say that doesn't matter."
"How could it not matter? And you cooked for Alfred when you were living here before, and for other people."
"Yes, of course. It's how I made my living."
"Well, then, you cook. I trust you." Mary made that first pot of stew with the boys in mind, and hummed as she chopped the carrots and the celery. Only when it came time to ladle it into bowls did she feel something nagging her, a sharp chill that started behind her neck and traveled down her back. She hesitated, but they were already lusting after the bits of tender meat, the steam rising up to their cheeks as the snow floated down the air shaft. They reached for their bowls, and she handed them over, and after, for several weeks after, even after telling herself it was fine, it was completely fine, they'd gotten into her head was all, they'd made her nervous of herself without true cause. She found herself observing them for signs of illness, and wondered if this was a sign of her guilt, a sign of admitting that she knew something that she could not face. But they never did get sick, not even a head cold, so she kept cooking for them. Shepherd's pies and roasts and coq au vin, quiche with bacon and leeks. She felt both happier than she'd felt since 1907, and angry once more that she'd signed the paper promising to never cook for hire again. "So, what will you get?" Mila asked that evening when they finished supper, the blue-black shells in a pile at the center of the table.
"You're still not allowed to cook?"
"No." She'd been wondering since leaving the DOH if baking counted as cooking, or if it was a different category altogether. She thought of the dairyman upstate who was allowed to stay on and supervise his dairy. There was a bakery looking for help not 5 blocks away.
"Ah," Mila said. "And they would know, I suppose?"
Mary nodded.
"How would they know?"
Mary didn't know how they would ever find out, but she had signed the paper. They would return her to North Brother if she lied to them and was caught.
"Do you think bacon counts as cooking, or is it a separate category?"
Mila considered the question very seriously.
"Baking is a different thing, and anyone who says otherwise doesn't know about either one."
"That's what I think, too," Mary said. The next morning, she walked to the bakery that had advertised for help. The man who managed the place showed her their equipment, explained how many rolls, buns, cakes, and pies they made and sold daily.
There was a front counter, where people could come in and order from what was displayed behind the glass, but most of the business was in the large orders that went directly to grocers nearby. He quizzed Mary about her experience, and then, leaving her alone in the kitchen with the other baker, instructed her to make something that showed them what level of skill she had. "Where's the cocoa?" Mary asked, opening and closing cabinet doors, pulling and pushing drawers. "Do you have a double boiler?" The other baker, an older woman named Evelyn, pointed to a corner of the counter. She stayed silent but watched closely as Mary gathered ingredients. Mary saw her looking from the corner of her eye as she folded and poured and whipped and mixed. When the timer dinged, Evelyn dropped the pretense and turned from her work to watch Mary remove the soufflés from the oven. "Wait, they might still fall."
"They won't fall,"
Mary said, and they didn't. The manager took her name without showing any sign of recognition and told her to report first thing in the morning. Mondays were mostly rolls and buns, Fridays mostly cakes and pies. In between was a free-for-all, from cranberry nut bread to fried dough to custom cakes decorated with sugar flowers. He sent her home with 2-day-old apple strudel, and she held the box flat in her palm all the way, thinking of what the boys would say when she showed them, thinking how they'd rush through their dinners with their eyes on the oil-dotted box. "What will I say?" she demanded of herself 3 months later, the next time she walked up to the DOH office where she'd once again sign, next to her name, her residence, her place of work. It was August now, and they were baking with blackberries and apricots. She brushed flour from her sleeves in the front of her dress. She washed her hands thoroughly and loosened the pins that kept her hair in a severe bun while she was mixing and beating and pouring. She told them at the bakery that she had to bring an ill neighbor to the hospital, and Jacob, the manager, told her to be back in 1 hour. One day, when she got the courage, she might march Mila and the Borriello boys to the DOH headquarters to say that she'd cooked for them and they had survived. But then they'd just say what they always said, which was that it didn't matter. Some people were immune. Some people had protection built into them already. And sometimes she wasn't infectious. Maybe she'd write to Mr. O'Neill about helping her get back to cooking. But not today. Not yet. And when the man asked her where she'd found employment since her last visit, she was about to tell him, getting ready her argument that baking and cooking were entirely different occupations, when instead she heard herself say that she worked in a shop as an assistant. "What kind of shop?" the man asked. Mary brought forth her thickest brogue. "Oh, one of them kinds of shops that sell nice things to rich people. Pretty-looking things." As he scrutinized her, she tried to look and feel as blank as possible. A middle-aged woman with a thickening waist, poor posture, ugly shoes. She blinked. She scratched behind her ears. "Trinkets?" he asked. "What sort of pretty things?"
"I don't know. Colorful things. I don't see much of the selling as I work in a room at the back."
It was all true, in a way. All true if you slanted it a bit, made the colors run together. A girl came in with a stack of files and placed them on his desk. He sighed, pushed the pile to the side, and then scribbled, "Shop assistant," in Mary's file and handed it to her. "Put the address," he said. She took the pen from him and held it in the air for a moment as her mind raced, and she realized she was about to write the real address. She changed the street number by 1 digit. An honest mistake, she could say later. I wasn't entirely sure. She signed. He signed. Then he summoned the secretary and told her to lead Mary down to the basement to give her sample. Mary knew her own way to the small room, but she was escorted anyway, and once there, a nurse made conversation about the weather, about Vinnie Ray being shot outside the stage door of the Hippodrome, about the sanitation department's new plan to remove garbage at midnight, about a shipping company owned by J.P. Morgan announcing that it was building the world's first unsinkable ship, while Mary squatted over a bright white bucket and prayed to God for something to happen so that she could be on her way. "Do you want me to get the bulb and syringe?" the nurse asked.
"No, I do not," Mary said. "I want you to leave me alone."
"Can't do that, ma'am," she tapped Mary's file. From her left, Mary heard the traffic of the hallway on the other side of the locked door, and on her right, the sounds of the street floated in the screened window. The nurse closed her eyes and leaned against the wall. "Stuffy in here," she said. "Feel anything?"
"I'm not doing this," Mary said, pulling up her underthings, straightening her skirt.
The nurse took a step forward. "It hasn't been 30 minutes. Look, why don't we take a break and try again in a while? You don't want to have to come back tomorrow, do you?
Can I bring you a glass of water? You can drown yourself in the river if you like, Mary said as she walked across the room and opened the door. I'm leaving. 20 minutes later, she was cracking eggs into a ceramic bowl. She didn't go back the next day, or the next week. She expected them to look for her, but they didn't. Summer ended, and in the autumn she and Evelyn baked with pumpkin, nutmeg, clove. Sometimes, when Jacob said that a customer had requested fresh peaches or sliced strawberries placed on their cake or pie, she thought back to what they told her on North Brother about heating food until all the germs would die away. "Do you know what a germ is?" they'd ask her, like she was a child sitting for an examination. Only later, back in her hut, face down on her cot, the rush of Hellgate just 25 yards from her gable, would she try to make sense of what they told her about invisible microbes that floated in the air, that traveled up the nose and into the mouth. So many years later, it still sounded like a fairy tale meant for children, a little world too small for the human eye to see, or like religion, in that they were asking her to believe such a thing existed without giving her a chance to look at it, hold it, understand it. Standing there at her station, so far from North Brother, with the quiet of the kitchen, the familiar shape of Evelyn's bent neck, the light from the window shining over her work, the sound of bells jangling on the door up front, and then the different bell of the register drawer opening and closing, the rhythmic beat of her spoon against the bowl as she worked it, round and round and round the batter. She felt peaceful. She straightened slices of pear. Using her fingertips, she arranged blueberries into a neat semicircle, and then strawberries alongside. Quick as a blink, she wiped her finger into the ice cream bowl to see if it needed more sugar. She licked quickly from the mixing spoon and then, without thinking, plunged it back into the bowl. She made a sheet cake that would serve 40 with fresh whipped cream between the layers. The layers slid a bit while she was anchoring them. She touched them into place, touched them again, pushed the cream to the edges with her thumb. At the end of the day, when she washed all the stickiness from her hands, she recalled all those moments of touching, but she couldn't see how one small movement, one nudge, one lick, something all cooks do, all bakers, all mothers and grandmothers who had to see if a thing was finished, if it tasted right and good, how something so inconsequential, something she barely noticed herself doing, could mean anything. She went back to the DOH 3 months later, November 1911, signed the papers again, skipped the sample, and once again, she walked out of the building without being stopped. In the bakery, once December arrived, they crushed bits of peppermint and sprinkled them over icing. Mary stayed in her corner of the kitchen, Evelyn in the other, and they worked in peaceful silence. Sometimes sugar burned, sometimes pots boiled over, but for the most part, their movements in the kitchen were harmonious, one pushing a pan into the oven when the other pulled one out. If Mary's timer rang while Evelyn was near the oven, she would open it and check on what was in there, and Mary did the same for her. She worked hard, stayed on her feet for 10 hours straight, ate a dinner of burned corners and day-old bread, and every night she went to sleep happy. Another Christmas, another bitter winter. The Hudson froze and children skated on its shores. Several times Mary thought she spotted Alfred, once entering the bakery, another time loping up the avenue, but it was never Alfred. And she hoped that wherever he was warm and dry. Maybe he'd gone to Canada. He'd always said New York was too small for him, too cramped. Maybe he'd gone south. With so many Negroes moving north, it was said that there was work down there. Or maybe he was still in New York City, back with Liza Meany. Maybe they'd married and gone upstate. Maybe Liza had helped him back on the wagon and gone through with the marriage. Maybe they'd had a child together. When 1912 came, Mary remembered that Alfred would have a birthday that year, having only one in every four, and calculated how many birthdays he'd had so far, and how it always seemed to soothe him, seeing February 29th on the newspaper, as if it proved that the date really did exist, and so did he. On the day after Alfred's birthday, Mary heard it said that a man had jumped from a moving airplane with the help of an enormous silk cloth that unfurled from a backpack as he floated all the way to the ground, unharmed, and it struck her that Alfred would be interested in that. It's the kind of thing that would have kept him home for an evening, to talk about that with Mary, how man was getting more and more clever every year. There was no use thinking of Alfred anymore, or expecting him to appear, or feeling as if he was watching her sometimes, or thinking of things she would say to him if she ever saw him again. She'd known him more than 20 years, and late at night, when she was tucked into her cot in the Borriello's kitchen, the boys snoring in the room beside her, the vent rattling behind the stove, the voices of other tenants traveling up the air shaft so that she could hear their questions as plainly as if they were sitting at the foot of her bed, she quizzed herself. Do you really think Alfred is gone for good? It had been 15 months since she'd seen or heard from him. Yes, she whispered to those who might hear her along the air shaft, and pulled the blankets up around her shoulders. But, shrouded inside her mind, hidden so well sometimes she feared she'd never find it again, was a single flame that she cupped with her hand and blew into and added twig after twig to. He'll be back, she thought. And like every night when she had trouble sleeping, once she admitted what she knew was true, her head sunk deeper into the pillow, and she finally fell asleep. In April, the Titanic reached Queenstown, and Mary thought of what a beautiful journey that would have been compared to her own crossing. Only 5 days later, she'd not gotten 20 feet from her building when a newsboy shouted at her, J.J. Astor is lost on the Titanic, as many as 1,800 dead. He waved the New York Daily Courant in her face, and she fished out coins to purchase it. People were huddled around, sharing their copies and reading bits aloud. And Mrs. Astor? A woman called.